Welcome. I'm John Podesta. I'm the president of the Center for American Progress. And we appreciate you all being here. Quite a turnout for a very important book. This is the latest of our breakfast forums. And we're here to discuss Lisa and Frank's book on putting a price on human life, the costs and benefits of cost-benefit analysis. I'm going to turn this panel over. We're going to get Frank up here, I think. I'm going to turn the panel over to Sally Katzen in just a moment, but I would just, by way of introduction, say that many of us who are on this panel have actually been working on these issues for many years. I guess I first met Jim Tozzi in the 1970s, and I want to thank him for being here today. We probably go back to the time when Ralph Nader actually was still trying to make cars safer rather than taking a second run for president. So, you know, some things get better, some things get worse. The environment, workplace safety gets a little bit better. Other, you know, some things get worse. But it really, I think, is important to discuss this. We've got a long history of trying to improve the regulatory process. I think by any measure of rough justice, I think we can see that effective regulation does work in this country and around the world. And we've got cleaner water, we've got cleaner air than we had back in those days when we first started working on these things. And I think by any stretch, by any fair analysis, I think the benefits far exceed the cost of that have been imposed on the country. But yet I think there's also opportunity to learn, to try to improve, to try to make, to use new technology, to try to use information technology to improve our understanding and analysis of how we regulate, why we regulate, and the kinds of tools that we use to provide the most effective regulation for the American public. This book, I think, is an extremely important contribution to that. So I'm not going to stand up here and speak for a long time. Lisa Heitzerling and I are colleagues on the Georgetown law faculty, so in that context I welcome her, but my duties really are to introduce Sally, who again has been at the forefront of trying to make a sensible regulatory policy and platform in this country, was the head of OIRA at OMB, and then the deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget during the Clinton administration, where we worked quite closely together. She is now a visiting professor at the University of Michigan Law School and has taught at Smith College, and is probably one of the people in Washington who I think is respected by all sides of the debate on improving regulatory tools. So with that, let me turn it over to Sally Katzen.
Good morning, and thank you all for coming this morning. I would like first to thank John and the Center for convening this program on this subject. The fact that all of you were able to get out of bed this morning and get here is testament to its importance. In fact, cost-benefit analysis, which is at the heart of what we're talking about today, has clearly become increasingly more important in the field of public policy. But to be precise, the courts do not employ cost-benefit analysis in reaching their decisions or justifying their decisions. And the Congress rarely, if ever, considers cost-benefit analysis in enacting legislation or in even drafting legislation. The cost-benefit analysis has been playing an increasingly prominent role in the development of the regulations that implement that legislation, at least by executive branch agencies. I have to put to one side the independent regulatory agencies, which play by their own rules sometimes. How has this come to be? Well, summarizing 30-odd years in less than 3 minutes, let me say that cost-benefit analysis began to be used in a few rulemaking proceedings in the 70s under Nixon, Ford, and Carter. There were a few scholars who wrote about the subject, a few fans of the approach in the agencies, and most importantly, in the executive office of the president, and a few critics, primarily among the public interest groups. A significant step occurred under Reagan and his regulatory executive order, which instructed the agencies to maximize net benefits, and it used other words to that effect, and it placed responsibility for reviewing the agency's works in the hands of OMB. President Clinton continued this general scheme, albeit emphasizing that costs and benefits that could not be quantified nonetheless had to be considered, and also worked to increase the transparency of the process so that there was greater understanding of what was happening during the review by OMB and greater accountability. President Bush kept President Clinton's executive order, but revised the guidelines for agencies conducting regulatory analyses. What were once guidelines are now requirements. He issued, this is John Graham in the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, issued new standards for data quality and proposed to impose peer review on the agency's analyses. Throughout this history, there has been debate, sometimes polite and civil, sometimes not so polite, not so civil. Questions such as whether there is, in fact, a level playing field, whether both sides of the equation, costs, benefits, are equally and readily able to be quantified and monetized, or whether there is an inevitable tilt. Whether the product of all of this effort, the results, are informative or dispositive, and whether it is all worth the effort in terms of staff time and resources, because cost-benefit analysis is not cost-free. Do the costs of cost-benefit analysis justify? Got it backwards. Do the benefits of cost-benefit analysis, I'm not a morning person, justify, let alone outweigh the costs of cost-benefit analysis? In short, is this the silver bullet, or is this a misguided, possibly immoral folly? We are fortunate to have together today people who have worked extensively and thoughtfully in this field. And I'm looking at the audience now before I even get to the panel. I thank you all for coming, and we will be hearing from you shortly. But first, we want to hear from our panelists, who are well worth listening to. In order of appearance, I bring you Lisa Heiserling, who is a professor of law at Georgetown Law Center, as John had mentioned. She comes to us from Princeton and then the University of Chicago Law School, where she was editor-in-chief of the Law Review. She clerked for Judge Posner and then for Justice Brennan, and has worked in the field for over 20 years as an expert in administrative.
30 years?
That puts me older than I am.
20 years. I thought you started this as a child.
Junior high school.
Junior high school. Actually, it was grade school. She wrote a paper on the environment for third grade. All right. She's vice president of the Center for Progressive Regulation, which is working extensively in the area. Our next speaker will be her co-author of the book, Frank Ackerman, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Urban and Environmental Policy at Tufts University. He comes to us from Swarthmore College and a PhD in economics from Harvard and a BA in mathematics and economics. Actually, that was the Swarthmore piece, but I wanted to stress the mathematics because that always intimidates me. He is the author of many books, including Why Do We Recycle? Markets, Values, and Public Policy, and has worked extensively in this field from the perspective of the environmental, with emphasis on the environmental issues. Our third speaker is Jim Tozzi, a living legend in his own time. He did his undergraduate at Carnegie Tech and University of Pittsburgh and has a PhD in economics and business administration from the University of Florida. He spent over 20 years, 20 plus, in the federal government, and in 1996 started the Center for Regulatory Effectiveness. Most significantly for present purposes, he was instrumental in establishing the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs at OMB in the Reagan administration. So without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to Lisa.
You can sit.
I know, but we decided, we made a decision right now to stand, if that's all right.
I'm a moderator. They're making the decision.
We're following your example.
Thanks for coming this morning, and thank you to the Center for American Progress for organizing the event. It's a mystery. There's a lot of discussion about cost-benefit analysis in policy circles today, a lot of talk as if it is the ascendant, the predominant way of making decisions in health, safety, and environmental policy. I just want to open by stressing something that Sally actually referred to earlier a little bit, which is that in our law, actually, cost-benefit analysis makes very few appearances. In our health, safety, and environmental statutes, there's really among them, there's only one that specifically contemplates a formal cost-benefit analysis in which costs and benefits are quantified and monetized, which is the decision-making framework we talk about in our book. Many other statutes, most other statutes in these fields, require the consideration of costs in setting standards, but they do not require, or in my view, even allow formal cost-benefit analysis of the kind we're talking about today. Some statutes, most prominently the Air Quality Standards Program of the Clean Air Act, even forbid the consideration of costs in environmental standard setting. And so there's, at the outset, there's a bit of a puzzle. There's a lot of talk about cost-benefit analysis, a lot of talk as if it is the predominant method for making decisions, and yet in our laws it really plays quite a small role in the statutes that Congress has passed. And what a lot of people are saying is that all should change. We should do things differently. We should make decisions according to the methodologies of cost-benefit analysis rather than according to the methodologies that have developed over the last three decades. And I think here the underlying claim is that somehow our health, safety, and environmental laws have failed us and failed us severely. The conventional complaint I think that we would hear would be that they're too expensive, they're too cumbersome, economics is more important than the values these laws protect. But if we are good students of Frank Luntz, we know that's not the way that we should talk about these matters. And the way that we should talk is to say that we really like regulation, we're in favor of saving lives, we like nature, but we just want to do it better and smarter than we've done it in the past. And so a lot of critiques of current regulation and a lot of defenses of cost-benefit analysis aim to show that our system is mixed up, and the way it's mixed up is that we're spending too much money, and we're spending too much money on the wrong things. And the aim is to show that if we rearranged our priorities, we could save more lives or more money or perhaps both. And so what I want to do this morning for just a few minutes is to talk about a couple of the stories that have developed along these lines. That is, stories about how our regulatory system has failed us and why we need a better system. The most famous of these stories are based on charts that if you're at all, I think you're all familiar with this area, you've all seen them. They're charts that show how much we spend to save a life or a life year here in the United States through regulation. They're stunning documents. They show that the costs per life, for example, range from something around $100,000 or $200,000 to all the way up to tens of billions, with a B, billions of dollars per life saved. Some of the charts even show that we spend almost $100 billion per life year saved. So they're fantastic and arresting documents, and they suggest that we're spending a huge amount to save lives and life years in the United States. And the immediate conclusion one might draw from such charts is that if we spent our money differently, think of the good we could do. Think how much better we could do if we weren't spending $72 billion, for example, to save a life through formaldehyde regulation.
Now, John Graham, before he became head of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, was the author of one of these famous tables showing different interventions and how much they cost. He also went on then with a person named Tammy Tings to author another study in which she purported to show how if we did reallocate the money from the less effective programs to the more effective programs, how many lives could we save every year? And the answer is about 60,000. And so this was a stunning result, once again, the idea that our current regulatory system is not just expensive, it's not just cumbersome, but in the words of John Graham himself, it's committing statistical murder. We're killing people because we're saving them in the wrong way and in the most expensive ways. There are lots of problems with these claims. I'm going to just discuss a couple of them. One problem is that the tables that I'm talking about contain lots of regulations that were never, ever implemented by any agency in the United States. They also contain regulations that were never even proposed by any agency in the United States. The first study by John Graham and Tammy Tings, for example, included regulations that were simply hypothetical, that someone somewhere had managed to dream up and attach a number to, and were never, ever proposed by anyone. In fact, the most famous of the rules, the one that John Graham had widely publicized as showing the flaws in current regulation, a $99 billion per life year regulation of chloroform, was never proposed by any administrative agency. And so the studies do show that you could, if you really wanted to, if you thought there was a point in it, describe a set of regulations that would be real expensive if they were ever proposed, but it doesn't seem like there's a lot of point in that kind of exercise. Second, these studies also, in a very important way, beg the conclusion they set out to draw. That is, they beg the question they set out to answer, which is that people have been asking, well, if we're going to save lives through regulation, is there a way we can do it most cost effectively? And the conclusions of these studies is the way to do it is through safety regulations. Make people wear bicycle helmets and use car seats and safety belts and so forth. Things that produce life-saving benefits immediately. As opposed to environmental regulation, for example, which regulates toxic chemicals which cause things like cancer, which have a long latency period, and people aren't saved for quite a few years from the date from when regulation takes hold. Well, it turns out these tables also employ a technique called discounting, which you may be familiar with for financial decisions. The idea is a dollar in the future is worth more than a dollar today. Well, it turns out Graham and his co-authors believe that a life saved in the future is worth less than a life saved today. And if you discount lives saved in the future over any appreciable period at any appreciable discount rate, it turns out they get trivial, very small, very quickly. And so, in fact, when these analysts looked at cost per life saved, they looked at cost divided by a number that was rapidly approaching zero. That is, if you're saving lives in the future and discounting them, then the numbers are getting smaller and smaller in the analysis. And so the important point is, we can talk about discounting if you'd like in the question and answer, but right now I just want to point out the conclusion that these studies reached, which was that environmental regulation was the most expensive of the kinds of life-saving interventions we could enact, was built into the tables from the start through discounting. It was built in from the start. All right. Another point about these tables and the current critiques is that most people outside this room really won't understand them. They don't understand when somebody says in a little footnote, lives were discounted at a 7% rate to arrive at these numbers. People don't understand that. And one of the things that Frank and I think cost-benefit analysis manages to do, and we're not sure that this is unintentional, by the way, it manages to cut people out of the process of decision-making, to make them think that these decisions about the environment, about their own health, about their own lives, are things that they can't understand. They can't really talk about. They don't know about discount rates. They don't know about wage premium. And so one of the critiques that we would raise is not only in addition to the technical problems and the problems about question begging is the fact that the cost-benefit analysis tends to speak in this language that most people don't understand. It also tends to rely on a critique of people's understanding of risk itself. And this is another of the stories that circulates in these policy circles, which is that people are real confused about risk. They're more scared of power plants, nuclear power plants, than they are of x-rays. And so what we need is we need a decision-making framework that will essentially take out the emotions, take people out of the process, and put in people who will look really just at risk, the probabilities of harm and the magnitude of harm, and that's that. Well, let me point out a couple of figures to you to test your agreement with this. About more people die in the United States every year, and that is every year, from ulcers and viral hepatitis than died in the September 11th attacks. That's every year. Right. We haven't remade American society because of ulcers and viral hepatitis. Right. We regard those kinds of risks as different. And they're different not because the numbers are different. The numbers of dead are actually even larger so far from ulcers than they are from terrorism. One of the differences in these kinds of risks is obviously they're frightening for a lot of ways, the terrorism and other similar kinds of risks. One of the differences is that we really don't know the worst case. We don't know the worst upside number that could be hurt by something like terrorism. And so I think most people agree that we should treat risks differently by looking at the context in which the risk arises. Terrorism is different from ulcers. Right. And one of the points that we make in the book is that it is only rational to consider what's the worst thing that could happen. This is what a lot of people do when they make real big decisions. They ask, what's the worst thing that can happen? In fact, we point out that there's a fancy economic theory behind this, which is always nice if you have a fancy economic theory that proves what everybody knows to begin with, which is authored by, among others, Kenneth Arrow. And the idea is that when you really don't know the probabilities, when you really don't know the probabilities, then the best thing to do, the most rational thing to do, is to look at the best case and the worst case. Look at the extreme. Don't pretend you can have some precise number in the middle that'll tell you the reality. Look at the extremes. And in our case, what we're saying is we should look at the extremes. What if there turns out to be no risk from the threats we're talking about? What if the risk turns out to be catastrophic? Look at those extremes and think about which one you're prepared to live with if you turn out to be wrong. You want to spend a little bit more money on regulation? You want to have the polar ice caps melt and the Gulf Stream shut down. Right? So if you look at those extremes, and I just want to close by pointing out the Pentagon is actually pretty good at this. I don't know if you've seen the news accounts. They're just beginning to seep out in the United States now, although European papers have been all over them in the last few days. Pentagon last fall completed a secret study of what they called the abrupt climate change scenario. A plausible but extreme case, they called it, of what would happen if climate change occurred over the next 5 to 15 years rather than over the next century. And it's not good if it happens, it turns out, over the next 5 to 10 years rather than over the next century. And the authors of this study, who are no wide-eyed environmentalists, they're just regular old Pentagon kind of analysts, said that we could expect food, water, and energy shortages leading to massive political instability and violent conflicts. Now, why do I raise this point in this context? Because what they did is they looked at what they regarded as a credible worst-case scenario and told us what they think the results might be of that situation. And that's what we're arguing for. In environmental cases, we should look at a credible worst-case scenario, not pretend that we can put some arbitrary mid-level estimate of the consequences might be. So in the end, I would just say maybe the Pentagon should talk to OMB and the EPA about what it's found. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Lisa. And as Frank moves to the podium, could I get the people on the back steps to move to chairs to make room for other latecomers? There are spaces down here. We won't call on you if you sit in the first few rows. In fact, it's more likely we'll call on you if you stay where you are. There are seats, particularly on this side, lots of seats. There's one right down here. We welcome you. Good morning. Thank you. Excellent. And now, talk about fancy economic theories. I get
exactly. Well, supposing that we were to put aside all the very important doubts that Lisa talked about and try to plow ahead with a cost-benefit analysis, moving into the territory of all these numbers that intimidate people. One wonders how much that's the point sometimes. But supposing that we said we were going to evaluate the costs and benefits of regulation, the first thing you notice is that the costs and benefits are very different. The costs tend to be things like how much does it cost to put some kind of filter on a plant, for instance. They're often hardware costs. Engineers know a tremendous amount about these costs. There are problems. Costs are routinely overestimated in advance. There have been a couple of interesting studies that show that costs of environmental protection go down after implementation much more often than they go up. So there's a little bias there that you could correct for. But those costs are meaningful monetary costs. They're properly denumerated in dollars. To make the cost-benefit analysis do anything for you, the benefits have to also be denominated in dollars. They have to be meaningful figures for the benefits. That's the engine that makes the whole thing go. And what if you looked under the hood and there's nothing there? But what I want to talk about, what happens as you look at what is done to produce dollar figures for benefits. The benefits of environmental protection, of health and safety regulations, are almost never monetary. A small part of them are naturally monetary, avoided health care costs. Most of them are avoided deaths, avoided serious illnesses, avoided environmental destruction, avoided loss of wilderness or species. And cost-benefit analysis absolutely requires that we put dollar values on those, and nature abhors a vacuum. Numbers have rushed in, but they are not terribly sensible numbers. So let's start talking about the value of life. Many regulations have their principal benefit of avoiding a certain number of deaths. What's it worth to not die? What's it worth for society to avoid a certain number of deaths? Well, this has been viewed as a technical question. The answer in the EPA under Clinton was $6.1 million. Under Bush, it's $3.7 million. Where do these numbers come from? The Clinton number, which I don't know if one can refer to one of these numbers as less absurd than the other, but the number which was at sometimes quoted as 5 million per life early in the 90s, carefully adjusted for inflation as if nothing had changed but inflation, so it reached 6.1 million by the end of the 90s, is based on studies of more and less risky jobs and the wage differentials, comparing the wage premium that you get for doing a more risky job. Economists did studies of huge numbers of workers. It's as if you compare two jobs that have the same skill requirements, the same in every way, except one is more risky than the other. And you say, if you're paid a little bit more for the risk, let's pretend that that is precisely the value of that risk. I try to picture two jobs that seem the same, working on the docks on a fishing, unloading a fishing boat versus going out on the boat where you might be lost at sea. If workers faced a completely voluntary choice, if they were perfectly well informed about the difference between those two jobs, if nothing differed but the risk, and if the workers who made that decision precisely expressed society's average valuation of risk as they made their workplace decisions, then you could read from that exactly how society values risk. That's all you have to assume. Almost all deaths on the job are male blue-collar workers, and in fact, they're a minority of male blue-collar jobs. My guess is that nobody here has ever worked in a sawmill, on a commercial fishing boat. I'm less sure about piloting a small plane. You know, those are the kind of jobs that are dangerous. Roofing, anybody here worked as a roofer in construction? I mean, much more one hand for roofing. Okay. We're not quite shut out here. But even most blue-collar workers have never done that. The fact that a few people will take risks for a certain amount, the fact that people value individual risks at a certain rate, the fact that they take jobs under economic duress not knowing what the risks are, and the fact that an individual decision in the workplace might not be how we decide about carcinogens being released into the environment for all of us, all of that totally invalidates the notion, why should our prospective regulation of air and water regulation be based on what it took to get somebody to work on roofing rather than ground level construction? And the studies are in many cases 20 years old, so it's what did it take 20 years ago, carefully adjusted for inflation, of course. The Bush administration, possibly looking for a lower number, but in any case coming up with a lower number, decided they didn't like that. They preferred surveys that are done where you get people to go to a computer center and spend hours answering questions about abstract hypothetical scenarios which differ slightly in the risk and what would you pay to be in this imaginary world instead of that imaginary world that has a different level of risk. You pay people $25 to spend the morning doing it. You have already selected for people who have time on their hands and are susceptible to small monetary incentives, who may not be typical of the rest of us. Anyway, you come up with this 3.7 million number. One study that did this tried to separately ask these questions of older people and got 2.6 million for older people. A lot of the people who die from air pollution are older. So they ran with that number for a while, and the author of the study disowned that calculation. That's the value of life. That's the linchpin of most cost-benefit analyses of environmental protection. The studies of health effects, other than that, are, if anything, worse. There are wonderful scales of the costs of different illnesses, looking at the quality-adjusted life years, disability-adjusted life years. There are a number of different systems that have been proposed. Let's arrange all problems on a scale from 0 to 100. The problem is if you put death and headaches on the same scale as these things do, then you can calculate a certain number of headaches are worth a death. Almost no one who suffers from chronic headaches feels that way. The arsenic cost-benefit analysis, which first got me into this field, had to evaluate not only a death, that was easy, that was $6.1 million, because it was done under Clinton, but they also had to evaluate non-fatal cases of bladder cancer, because a lot of people get bladder cancer from arsenic, don't die of it. And they said, we don't have a clue what the value of a case of bladder cancer is. We can't find anyone who's ever done one of these wonderful studies of a case of bladder cancer. As luck would have it, somebody studied the value of chronic bronchitis 15 years ago, and it's apparently close enough to bladder cancer for government work. So aside from not wanting to go to those particular people for your health care, you look closely at how was chronic bronchitis valued 15 years ago in this wonderful study. Economists who were at Duke, so they hired a survey team to go to a shopping mall in Greensboro, North Carolina, and again, corral shoppers there, and ask them hypothetical questions about what if you could live in your neighborhood versus another neighborhood that had a slightly lower cost of living but a higher risk of chronic bronchitis. Which would you prefer? And varied the numbers on how much lower the risk of chronic bronchitis was versus how much different the cost of living was. And two-thirds of the people were able to answer this. One-third got bounced for not being able to play this game. And that number produced a estimated value for avoiding a case of chronic bronchitis, carefully adjusted for inflation for 15 years, and then smeared into be the value of a case of non-fatal bladder cancer. Try to imagine. The engineers, meanwhile, evaluating the cost, said, well, there are 13 different technologies for removing arsenic, depending on this water system, the geology of your area. Imagine if one of the engineers had said, well, we don't actually know the price of that pump, but we can get the price of the wrong piece of equipment from a shopping mall in Greensboro, North Carolina, 15 years ago, and we'll adjust it for inflation. The benefit numbers are absurd. They are not monetary figures. They are not reasonable approximations of what society believes. Now, in making this critique, I often feel like a dissident in the economics profession. There aren't that many other economists who think this. You may have noticed. the more sympathetic version of let's do cost-benefit analysis, let's value these externalities, economists call them, effects that are outside the market. The sympathetic version of this says, what if we could come up with really big numbers? What if we could do the studies better and find that there's a really big dollar value to the environment, so there must be a really big value protecting it. Cost-benefit analysis could become a force for good rather than what it in fact always seems to be. The examples of this, the big values that come up, are mostly values of nature. This is a little bit complicated point. We talked about it in Chapter 7 of the book. But there are the values of using nature and the values of the existence of nature, and economists think about them separately. And the really big numbers are always the value of the existence of nature, the use of nature, the number of, you know, what do people pay going to parks, what does it actually mean in your life that you use it, is different from what is the existence of it. I mean, I've never been to the Grand Canyon, right? Even if I never get there, its existence means something to me. Almost no one has ever been to Prince William Sound, where the Exxon Valdez spilled, and yet that meant something to people all over the country. It meant something like 30 times as much as the direct value of what was lost to the fishermen and the tour boats in Prince William Sound. So the big numbers are always the existence values. The use values are, in fact, quite small. And aside from the fact that they're often rejected in cost-benefit studies, they're so large that nobody believes them. The existence of the animals protected by the Endangered Species Act, some economists calculate, is about 48 times the fines that are levied under the Endangered Species Act. So you could say, well, we need to make the fines 48 times larger, but that, my guess is that's a non-starter in the discussion of the Endangered Species Act, right? No one will pay attention to something that says they should be 48 times larger. And these existence values, they get at something important, something very important about the way people think about health and the environment, but they are not actually anything like prices. A study was done saying that the value of the existence of the species of humpback whales to the American public was $18 billion. This was a few years ago, and I didn't adjust it for inflation, so it'll be even bigger now. But let's just go with $18 billion. The existence of the species of humpback whales, the American people tell, you know, do a survey, get the average household value, multiply by the number of households, and it's worth $18 billion. So try this thought experiment. Supposing some crazed billionaire somewhere offers to pay $36 billion, twice the price, maybe even adjusted for inflation, for the right to kill all the humpback whales in the ocean. Is that a bargain? Now, say if you just bought a car for $20,000 and somebody offers you $40,000 for it, good chance you'd take it. Even if you didn't take it, you're not offended. But my guess is that if you're somebody who cares about whales and you contributed to this calculation that the humpback whales are worth $18 billion and someone offers to pay $36 billion for the species, it doesn't sound like a good deal. You're probably offended by the offer. And so these existence values, the fact that something that you don't touch has a value to you, it doesn't just have to be for inanimate objects and wilderness, doesn't just have to be for other species. I mean, the lives of people who work in sawmills and roofing and fishing boats far away from me have a value to me, as well as nature and so on. That what we say in the book is that these existence values are real, but they are not really numbers. They tell us that people value things, but in all of these cases, there is a complete failure to come up with meaningful numbers that express this. So if you can't put a dollar value on the benefits in any meaningful way, the cost-benefit enterprise falls apart. You are left only pointing at the costs, which I have to say is what some studies claiming to be cost-benefit analyses have started to do. There is no hope of completing the agenda of cost-benefit analysis because the benefits are not really monetary. Thank you.
I must say that the first time I read in the newspaper that there was going to be a new center in Washington, and it was going to be headed by John Podesta, I knew that we were going to have a new force in Washington. And look at this crowd on this subject is a living testament that there's going to be a new power center in the public policy area in Washington, headed by John. Sitting here, Sally picked out the seating orders, and I must say it's the first time I've been to the left of Sally, Frank, and Lisa. In musical terms, this gig would be, you would call the panel we have here the warm-up band. And years ago, I was a wannabe musician in New Orleans, and you're really the big event, as Sally said, because we want to hear your comments. Years ago, and I was in a music business in New Orleans, and I was in a warm-up band, and you know, the second band, always you always wonder who's in the first band. And they said, "Oh, don't sweat it." And I said, "What's the cat's name?" And they said, "Well, Harry Connick." I feel in the same position after I follow Lisa and Frank today. I want to discuss this book, and I really think it's a very interesting book. And one could comment at it in the abstract as one book, but I think it might be appropriate to look at it in terms of the spectrum of books that have been written on benefit-cost analysis. And I must say that the articulate comments of Frank and Lisa today don't completely do justice to the book, because the book is at a level a lot higher than their comments in terms of macro policies that govern benefit-cost analysis, and I urge you to read it if you haven't read it. And if you look at the spectrum of benefit cost analysis and what they've addressed, and if you've looked at the number of books written over time on this, is that they're done mainly by economists, and they get into very arcane topics such as the social discount of race versus the opportunity cost of capital and a lot of other things. This book, I think, goes after benefit-cost analysis in an entirely different vein. Some is on ideology and some are on extremely basic principles. And I think this book, how it's written, the shelf life of the criticisms will probably be a little longer than others, because, as Lisa said, people will be able to understand the criticisms of this when you really get into the book. Now, let me just give Sally's a tough taskmaster, so I got my watch up here. Let me just give you some of the books and the continuum and see how this fits in. If I had to pinpoint an area where benefit-cost analysis started in the government, it was a result of the 1936 Flood Control Act. No, I wasn't there then. I'm just reading the book. Okay. And in 1936 Flood Control Act directed the Corps of Engineers to build only those projects to whomsoever the benefits exceeded the cost. So from 1936 up to the early 60s, the majority of benefit-cost analyses in the government was done by the Corps of Engineers. And some of you might question those analyses. In any event, the outputs of those products were somewhat vendable. You had flood control, you had water supply, things that could be measured. And there was a host of books written on benefit-cost analysis. John Cutillo from RFF, Arthur Mounts from Harvard, Bob Haberman from Grinnell, and a number of others. Then what happened is in 1969, the first paper that I have seen written on applying benefit cost analysis to regulations was a colleague of mine. I was a system analyst in the Department of Defense under McNamara, and a guy named Alan Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-D, wrote a paper of how the government should move from benefit cost analysis of capital projects to regulations. That paper is on our center's website if you want to look it up, or just put his name in Google and you'll find it. And if there's one paper that I would state that was seminal in leading to the review of regulations by Office of Management and Budget, and I was in defense then, was that particular paper. Now, if you take then this series of books, the big jump was when we start reviewing regulations, the outputs of regulations are somewhat different than the outputs of capital investment projects. And a lot of the problems that you hear in this book of criticism of benefit cost analysis result from that transition from capital improvement projects to regulations that have more social dimensions. And this is one of the first books that doesn't address per se that timeline, but most certainly the concern in the jump from capital evaluation of projects to regulations that have social outputs. Now, let's address this point. First thing, if you read the book in its entirety, the basic point, and as Lisa and Frank both said, if you get too mired in the details of benefit cost analysis, the general public will think experts of the world said this is not worth it, don't do it. And I defy very many people to go through one of these analyses, including practitioners in the field. So to the extent that people use benefit cost analysis as determinative, I agree with the thrust of that portion of the book. Mainly that it's one thing to look at it, most certainly not determinative. Now let's get to the two basic points I think the authors state. One, it says, and I'll quote, "The basic problem with narrow economic analysis of health and environmental protection is that human life, health, and nature cannot be described meaningfully in monetary terms. They are priceless." That's one point, and I'll get to that in a second. It says, "Resources, of course, ultimately are limited, but there is no evidence that we've approached the limits of what is possible. There's no evidence that these corporate burdens are or about to be unaffordable. Furthermore, even if this constraint is real, benefit cost analysis is incoherent." Let me discuss those two points, because I think those two points and the authors are right up front in the book that are the thrust of the book. With respect to the first statement, namely that it's narrow, I would say yes, but obviously there are a number of deficiencies in benefit cost analysis, and they're documented by a number of scholars. And those in the economics profession that tend to make these determinative, I think, are overstating most certainly the thrust of the tool. However, cost-benefit analysis is one thing that should be looked at with all of its constraints. The problem is, in some areas, it's becoming determinative. And that, I think, is a management problem, not one of economics. It's putting these tools in their appropriate light when they're looked at decision-making process. To the extent they become determinative, I don't think you throw out the tool because there's a management inefficiency in the system or a system of perception that you can't control, either overly aggressive economists or in some cases overly aggressive attorneys. So in any event, I think that question that Frank and Lisa wrote could be done by appropriate management or proper use of benefit cost analysis. Now, I think the second term point they have is I don't know, it might have been written before, but it sure didn't stand out in critiques of benefit cost analysis. Really what they're saying, they're not saying we're not resource constrained. They're saying in the box of where we're analyzing now, resource constraints the available resources are so great, we're working in a box where there's really not any economic scarcity. Now that's somewhat ideological. That is a point that I'm not in a position to prove or disprove. However, neither have the authors. That's one point, I think, a fundamental point they made in the book. I haven't seen any data to back that point up or citations. Anything I think they would make on that at this point would be somewhat anecdotal, as well as what I will give you on the other side of that point. I might might be somewhat anecdotal. But in the last quarter, the PricewaterhouseCoopers conducted a survey of CEOs, not in the United States, throughout the world. And the conclusion of the report was that, quote, unquote, overregulation, as is the single greatest threat to their business, greater than any other single risk, including global terrorism. This is not me speaking. This is a thing of CEOs from the most underdeveloping countries to developed countries. And it's at the Pricewaterhouse site. Now, let's look at that concern. Let's look at two couple other statistics. The gross domestic product of this country is $10 billion plus. The federal budget is $2 billion plus. It depends which economist you look at. The cost of regulations is around $1 billion plus. I would say that the scrutiny given to budget expenditures are considerably higher than that given to regulatory expenditures. Why? Because there's competition in the agencies, competition in the bureau, there's competition through OMB for that dollar. They don't employ formal benefit cost analysis, but most certainly there's a very strong competition for the buck. And they're subject to OMB review, they're subject to congressional review. I don't see that type of review in regulations. I think the agencies do some benefit cost analysis. I think OMB does a very good job in reviewing it. OMB has a couple dozen people working on this and a bazillion in the federal agencies. So I don't think that benefit cost analysis, and that's may be as prohibitive as it is. Now, as stated, but I do, as I said before, to the extent it becomes determinative, I think it's an overuse of the tool. Now, where does this leave us and the authors? The authors say that one of their basic premises is that they believe a holistic approach should be utilized. And they say this, that in its as an alternative benefit cost analysis, they say, in its place, we offer an attitude rather than an algorithm, one that trusts collective common sense judgments and is humble in the face of uncertainty, steadfast in confronting urgent problems, and committed to fairness within and beyond the generation. I think that's a good start. And what I would think that the authors should consider writing a sequel to this book. And the sequel to the book, I think, would not be with all these nice little economic concerns of discounting and senior discount. And did you see that thing where there was an older lady with gray hair said 30% off? I mean, whoever wrote that, I mean, it's really, really right on the ball. But anyway, let me go to the sequel. I think the sequel is this. I think that when President Reagan signed Executive Order 12291, another one followed right after that, where it said that every agency in the government had to send the totality of all its regulations, and there was an act passed to put in law, of its regulatory agenda and regulatory calendar. Those are published every year, every 6 months, of all agencies across, and it's on the CRE website, very easy, just press a button and the agencies come up. And I think that a holistic approach to looking at regulations would be for people to review and have a public debate on those regulations, look at the benefits, look at the benefit cost analysis, in essence use somewhat of a regulatory budget without numbers. And I think if their next book would look at that as a basic organizing mechanism and transpose on that a lot of their concerns, where there is this aberration and the jump from capital evaluation to regulations, it would be a great service. And again, I really recommend that you read this book, because its criticism is a lot more macro than a lot of the other ones have been written. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Before we turn, open the floor for questions, I wanted to give Lisa and Frank an opportunity to respond to anything that Jim said, although there seems to be violent agreement that there are deficiencies in, well, now he calls it benefit cost, they call it cost benefit. Do you see any pattern here? Do we need a psychologist to understand why One side is using the benefits first and the other side is using the cost first. But we seem to agree there are deficiencies in the basic analysis and that it should not be dispositive. But there are other differences that remain. So Lisa, Frank, would you like to comment?
Yeah, I want to disagree with what you just said. Which is also to disagree with something that Jim said, which is that the idea that it shouldn't be dispositive. And this is what people always say in the abstract when we're at sessions like this. They always say, oh, no. Cost-benefit analysis is not determinative. It's just something that we think about. It's just a tool to be used in decision-making. It's not dispositive, and that would be a bad thing. But when it comes time to evaluating rules, when it comes time to write that op-ed piece on the arsenic rule or the mercury rule or any other rule you care to mention, then it turns out, yes, cost-benefit analysis turns out to be dispositive, and all we hear about are the hard numbers. And so in theory, I think we are in agreement. In practice, I don't think so. What I see is it being determinative in a lot of people's judgments about important policies.
Let me just respond briefly, too. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised at our agreement here. Maybe the speaker who was going to criticize us couldn't make it. I'm not sure. But there are some subtler points of disagreement on this. I think in terms of the costs of regulation, I found a lot of people imagine when they hear about costs of regulation that there's a budget and that there's some allocation process going on whereby if good project A doesn't get the money, then good project B will get the money instead. And so we have to decide whether A or B is better. Most of the costs that are identified in cost-benefit analyses are not federal budget costs. I mean, you may know this. Some people I talk to in Boston are always astonished at this. Most of the costs are the costs that will be imposed on private companies. What's the cost? It's essentially, what's the cost of doing business? You know, and sure, regulations impose some kind of costs. You could figure out, what's the cost of not being allowed to use child labor? Probably costs something to some businesses. But, you know, we've decided that not having child labor is one of the minimum standards for doing business in the United States. And so you're not allowed to do that. And, you know, I think the question about environmental regulation, what should be the minimum standards for being in business, doing things that pollute the air or water, is a similar kind of question. If we say the costs of water pollution controls at a particular plant are so enormous that we can't afford it, and we roll back that regulation, what happens to that money that would have been spent cleaning up that river? There's no process that automatically transfers that money to another river where it can be cleaned up cheaper. It just stays on the bottom line of the company that didn't have to clean up the first river. So there might be something to it if we were mostly talking about allocating a fixed budget, which is the image that everyone imagines. If we're talking about what's the minimum standard for this company to be allowed to be in operation on that river and this company to be in operation on the other river, there's no common fund there. What you do over here and over here are the minimum standards for operating in two places, and there is no fund which is used up by doing one and isn't available for the other.
Well, let me throw out one thing. There was an OMB study that looked at the total costs and the total benefits of regulation. And they found that the costs of regulation, this is for 10 years, 92 to 2002, of 107 major regs, all the biggies, the costs were $36 to $42 billion. The benefits was $146 to $230 billion. Wow. Now, this was a study done by OMB under the Bush administration. It's in the 2003 report to Congress of the costs and benefits. Some have thought that, well, some were surprised that it came out. Some observed that when it did come out, a number of the critics of regulation were somewhat quieted and were at least less vehement in their objection to regulation. And some thought, wait a second, we can use this methodology to debunk the myth
that Lisa and Frank start with, which is the critics say there's all this horrific, expensive regulation. Something's wrong with the system. And now those who believe in regulation and its salutary effect on our lives can say, there's nothing wrong. We have benefits that so greatly exceed the costs, out of the words of the Bush administration, out of their own number crunching. So I would ask whether maybe there is a role for economics in public policy and that two can play the same game. And I can ask the panelists to comment on that, or we can begin to ask people in the audience. Anyone here want to comment? Lisa, and then we'll throw it open.
Most of those benefits in that study, a lot of them for environmental regulation, something like 90% of them came from programs under the Clean Air Act, most of them due to reduced premature mortality. The same time that OMB was writing that report, it was also busily approving rules to relax important requirements under the Clean Air Act that would have saved those same lives that were being valued in that report. And so it leaves me with a puzzle. If the benefits of the Clean Air Act are so enormous, why are we busily relaxing it?
Because maybe there's a political will or lack of political will. Jim?
Oh, I think that report doesn't make anyone's point. That analysis was done. It is not an OMB number. If we did that on the budget side, the deficit would be bigger than $500 trillion it is now. That report was a compilation of agency estimates. It was not scrubbed by OMB, and OMB served as a stapler of their reports and put it together. So any resemblance to reality is, I don't know where the numbers are, and I most certainly couldn't quote that in favor of regulation or against regulation, because OMB simply doesn't have the staff to generate those kind of numbers.
Yes.
They do have a stapler.
Let me just toss in
one more point on this. These huge benefits of the Clean Air Act came from studies done by the EPA in the 90s. I've heard from consultants at Industrial Economics, is a major consulting firm in Cambridge, that they've been hired to do a new study reanalyzing that and improving the methodology. So I think this is a process you keep doing till you get the answer you want.
Please, would you identify who you are?
Shall I stand up?
You can do whatever you'd like.
Bernard Russell from the Century Foundation. Any kind of decision is made, you've got to take everything and put it on a linear scale. Good, better, best, yes, no. You can't take multidimensional things because a decision is only one dimension. You can define that line in terms of dollars, and you can define it in terms of vibrations from the seat of your pants, or whatever you want, but it only has one dimension. You can either approach it rationally, trying to reduce all of these many dimensions to one dimension, or you can sort of say we're good people with good values and we're going to follow our hearts. It seems to me that it makes all kind of sense to try to rationalize that process. And the process does not only result in, you have a political expertise that I lack, but it needn't result in abrogating regulation. If you value species loss at an infinite value, it certainly will favor regulation. Nor does regulation always save lives. There's regulation that says you can't use things in your tires, I forgot what they're called, against ice, because it destroys roads. That results in, you're trading off lives against road maintenance. My basic point is that in order to make that decision rationally, it seems to me it makes sense to try to figure out what is the value of this compared to the value of that. And you can measure that value in dollars, or measure it in anything else, but you got to do something like that.
Let's have a few. Yes, please.
Holly Zeebo from Federal Times. Trying to get an idea of what the progressive vision is for regulation. We're talking today about how the most cost-benefit analysis don't want to evaluate lives. You want regulation created on a worst-case scenario, but you don't want peer review to make some sort of common idea about what that worst-case scenario is. hypothetically, let's say a business person does feel burdened by regulations, what recourse do you suggest they have? What sort of meaningful recourse do you think they have for just individual citizens in general against a burdensome regulation?
Well, you suggest we're against peer review, and I take it, I mean, we're not. And I guess I would say that one of the things that people would be able to, a business would be able to say in your hypothetical example is, we're not hurting anybody. We're actually not hurting anybody. We're in favor of science. We're in favor of scientific evidence. And if we're talking about, in your example, just to give it a little bit more concreteness, if we're talking about environmental protection, for example, it would be perfectly open to them to say, we're not hurting anybody. In many cases in regulatory structures in place today that a lot of people would like to replace with cost-benefit analysis, it is also open to the business to say, we will be put out of business if you do this to us. It's open to them to say, this will cost us an awful lot of money if you require this. There are lots of things that it's open to business to say to defeat regulation, even without cost-benefit analysis. The one thing we wouldn't let them say is, workers in the 1970s demanded a risk premium that was lower than the cost of this regulation, and therefore you shouldn't impose it on us. So we're in favor of all sorts of evidence and science. We're just not in favor of this last little bit of knowledge that has to do with monetizing life and then also discounting future lives saved. Jim?
I think if you want to look at another tool that's been used, it's a term called a regulatory budget. And one was put together for the government. It was done during the Carter administration. And a regulatory budget is simply just like a federal budget. You take all the regulations that are going to be issued in a certain period of time, and you add up the costs, and you debate whatever that budget level is going to be, and you look at all available information you have, and you decide which regs you want to go forward or not. That regulatory budget for the Carter administration is on our center's website. OMB never released it until I left. And I sort of released it. In fact, it's the only thing I did public in my life in a long time. But any event, and so I think if you're looking at macro tools to as an alternative to formal benefit costs, and I agree with Lisa to an extent, some of these have a life of their own. I think you ought to look at a regulatory budget, and maybe not with specific binding numbers, but you could move in that direction. If you want to look at one done, it's on our website. It was done during Carter for EPA.
There's another option as well that should at least be put on the table, and even indeed the current OMB is moving towards cost-effectiveness analysis rather than cost-benefit analysis or benefit-cost analysis. Cost-effectiveness measures per unit achieved. And so you don't have to value the life you're saving. It's what's the effectiveness per unit. You don't have to put a dollar value on cancer or any of the other end products. And I'm actually interested in whether Frank and Lisa take some comfort from the fact that the OMB, at least, it seems to be moving in that direction, and whether that is somewhat responsive to the kinds of concerns you have.
It's responsive in the narrow context where you have one precisely defined objective, and that's all you want to maximize. As soon as you have multiple objectives, you have the problem of, in effect, pricing them relative to each other. So if you know that your policy is only designed to save lives, and you want to say what's the cheapest way to save lives, and you're willing to go with whatever conclusion that comes to, even if it says ignore the war on terrorism and spend money on fighting diabetes, because it's much cheaper to save lives from diabetes than to guard every airport in the country against terrorism, I mean, that's a possible, I think a likely outcome of a study that says we want to save lives at the lowest possible cost. A few examples like that, and you start to think, was that actually a well-specified objective, or are our objectives so much more complex that single objective cost-effectiveness analysis doesn't take us very far?
Also, the idea, it's true that cost-effectiveness analysis does not require reduction to monetary terms, but it does require evaluation in an important sense. When I made my opening remarks, I talked about the cost per life saved tables and talked about the fact that they discounted future lives saved. That's a valuation process. It's valuing lives today versus valuing lives in the future. That is often extremely hidden in cost-effectiveness studies. So it requires valuation, just not the monetary evaluation that we've been talking about mostly today.
Okay, that sparks some comments here and then there and then up front. Sir?
To raise the important point of cost-effectiveness, and I think it's disappointing to have it right up front, because that would take into account your existence of, because then the data suggests that you often forget the open data. You don't get to harden the identity that you work against, which is the goal to improve the cost-effectiveness rate. So I think that's the thing I don't agree with, because we have answering and also the
yeah. Okay. Sir?
It's sort of a technical question. I'm not going to do the sense of science and the public interest. On the cost side of this, the people take into account discounted amount by looking at the alternative way of doing things. It's just like the environmental movement is possible, less than use it. Creates a tremendous amount of jobs and economic growth by doing things differently. When people do technical cost benefit analysis, do they take into account the economic growth and discount the amount of the cost side by what that is in general?
I think it's the only one who's actually, well, Jim did it in the early days, but during my tenure, yes and no. It's not part of the formal study, but when we say that cost-benefit or benefit-cost analysis is going to be informative, you take what you see. And if the benefits are so much greater than the costs, you don't even have to think about that step. If the costs are so much greater than the benefits, you might think that, in fact, technology forcing has produced, along with American ingenuity, enormous cost savings. The few retrospectives that have been done have shown that the costs have almost always been overstated. And you know that. You know that the benefits are often not fully realized, and you know that too. But it's rather a question in practice, at least during my experience, of looking to get a number and then work with it. That's why I said informative, not dispositive. To the extent that it becomes add up a column, add up another column, see what the difference is, and that's dispositive, then your question takes on enormously important significance, and the answer is yes and no, sometimes, but not always.
I just want to try to sharpen up a little bit. I haven't read the book, I'm all American Concerned Economist, but listening to Lisa and Frank, I heard you make some pretty fundamental critiques of the technique of cost-benefit analysis, in terms of social discount rates, the kind of studies relied upon, quantified benefits, et cetera. And Jim, you said it shouldn't be dispositive or determinative, but there are corporate uses for it. Do you agree with their fundamental critique? And if so, if the process or the technique is fundamentally flawed, what's the appropriate use in setting regulation? And for Frank and Lisa, given your critique of the technique as being fundamentally flawed, is there any appropriate use for cost-benefit analysis and regulation?
So, Jim?
First of all, I don't think there's any algorithm that you're going to capture and come up with a mathematical way of whether regulation should go forward. So I don't think there's any idea. But I do think that benefit-cost analysis, even with all these problems, are a guide. And it's a threshold. It says it lets you sort regulations into piles. Some of these are not so bad. Some should be looked at, or some are very good. So I'm going to be on a record that I think it should continue. I have to agree with the authors, though, that in many times it becomes dispositive. And I'll tell you where it really is. It's in the Corps of Engineers. You're on the other side of these issues, because once there's no way that the Congress will ever put money in a Corps project unless the benefits exceed the cost. I've testified on that program for 20 years. So there's a big push to make it the benefits however measured. And in that case, it meets all the problems that Lisa says. If it's over one you're eligible for appropriations. So my answer to that is that in those cases where it's that way, there's all these uncertainties, and management has to have a transparency of these numbers to show where the uncertainties are. But I most certainly wouldn't say, given this point in time, and given what I think is an increasing period of economic scarcity, to throw out this tool. I think the tool needs to be retooled in terms of its use, but not discarded.
I think that most of the information that goes into a standard cost-benefit analysis is useful for any decision-making process. Certainly identifying costs and certainly identifying benefits in their natural non-monetary units are both steps that you need to do for any decision-making process. What I think, I don't see a role for this monetization of the benefits that leads you to a bottom-line up or down answer. And I think this gets back to some of the other questions, the first one that we never talked about. Is there a ranking? You take all that information, there's a tremendous amount of information that's useful, and some decision has to be made, but there actually is this whole mathematical economic proof that there's no possible mathematical ranking that will reproduce consistently the decisions of a democratic decision-making process. I mean, the deliberative process cannot be replaced by a mathematical function. And, yes, in the cases where you have one completely specified objective cost-effectiveness analysis works, I think the public policy problem is almost always a multidimensional one where you don't have that option. So that you take this tremendous amount of information, maybe 90% of what's in a cost-benefit analysis is useful for any decision-making process. It has to be fed into a different kind of deliberative decision-making.
Lisa? I agree.